This is special programming on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm news director Sarah Bohannon. Tonight we'll hear why one case of COVID-19 in a community could mean there's a 50% chance a growing outbreak is already underway in that area. We'll take a look at how this pandemic is affecting domestic violence in the region and why officials and service agencies are ready for an uptick in cases. And NSPR's Dave Shalom takes us through a conversation with two researchers from UC Davis about the spread of infectious disease through animals. If there's a story you want to hear or information that you need to know, leave us a message on our message line, 433-9216. You can also reach us through our website, mynspr.org. For Wednesday, April 8th, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. First, the news.
For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert. The number of coronavirus infections detected among Californians reached 16,957 today. According to the California Department of Public Health, that's about 1,100 more than yesterday. The number of fatalities connected to the virus in California rose by 68 over the past 24 hours to 442. Officials report nearly 5,800 people are currently hospitalized across California with confirmed or suspected cases of the virus. 1,676 of them are being treated in intensive care, 46 more than yesterday. Despite vigilance training and safety gear, the virus is also increasingly spreading among healthcare workers. With a total of 1,651 infected statewide, only about a fifth of those have been confirmed to have contracted it on the job. The median age among those infected in California is around 49. In the latest numbers from North State counties, public health authorities discovered 5 more cases of COVID-19 today, pushing the region's total to 81. The number of deaths in the region remains at 5. Of the new cases, 2 each were identified in Shasta and Yuba counties and 1 in Sutter County. In all, Shasta County, where officials say community spread is active, has reported a total of 23 cases. 2 people have so far recovered. Sutter County is currently reporting 19 cases, Butte and Yuba 13 each. There are also 4 cases in Siskiyou County, 3 each in Colusa and Plumas, 2 in Glenn, and 1 in Tehama County. Both Lassen and Trinity counties continue to report no cases. Amidst the unsettling news, Robert Folden, chief operating officer at Mercy Medical Center in Reading, said he was pleased to report a good milestone today.
We had our first, I guess what we're going to call graduation from a patient who was here in the hospital and actually got to be discharged home. So that's a very positive sign from our standpoint.
At an event put together by public health authorities, Folden praised community members who've stepped forward donating masks and creating face shields from 3D printers. He also said regular logistics channels are also delivering.
Early this morning, a shipment of supplies. So who would have thought we'd be happy about a shipment of supplies? But we got a large crate of PPE. So that always feels good to see that coming in.
The 4 million Californians receiving SNAP, better known as food stamps, should be able to purchase their groceries online by May 1st. Officials say the change should reduce the chances that someone's exposed to the virus on a visit to a grocery store by letting people reduce or eliminate such trips. Also, we want to thank those who called in on Monday and yesterday to let us know of a correction we needed to make on the number of deaths we reported in the North State. The correction has been made and the numbers just reported are accurate. For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert.
This is special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Low testing rates across the country during this pandemic mean there are likely many cases of the virus going undetected. A new study out from the University of Texas at Austin shows that if a county has just one detected case of COVID-19, there is a 51% chance a growing outbreak is already underway. Considering all but 2 counties in our region have more than one case, NSPR's Andre Bayek spoke with the study's lead author, Emily Javon. The first thing he asked was what problems the researchers were trying to clarify.
One of the problems that we are worried about is that local governments may be waiting to see many cases detected before they start enacting any strict social distancing measures or other non-pharmaceutical interventions. And we really just wanted to get the point across that if you're waiting to count 10, 20 cases, that is too late. You need to start working before you even detect cases, and especially by the time you detect one or two.
What did you find?
That social distancing measures are going to be really critical because we see that the epidemic probability is very high for coronavirus. And in our study, coronavirus has a really high transmission. It's very easily spread from one person to another. And so even in our model, we accounted for using some social distancing, assuming everybody's doing a pretty good job. So even under that, it's still very high chance that you have an epidemic underlying these detections in your community.
It looks like you have a scale regarding certain numbers of detection. Can you explain that a little bit?
The scale goes from 0 to 1. 0 being you have no chance for an epidemic in your community, and 1 being the highest. You have a very high chance. And so as we increase the number of detected cases, we're increasing that chance that there is an underlying epidemic. And so our model, we're assuming that everybody is looking and able to catch about 1 in 10 of their cases, so 10% chance that you're going to find them. And so that's why by the time you've found one, there's already a large number of cases that you just haven't seen yet. So that's why when we jump from 0 detections to 1 detection, now our epidemic probability has increased.
I'm calling you from Butte County, California, where we have, as of now, about 13 confirmed COVID-19 cases here. What does that number 13 tell you about the spread of the virus in our community?
Well, some things you need to ask to compare with our model is how much testing is being done and who is getting tested. If the only people getting tested are like the most sick and the ones already coming in, right, it's not going to tell you how big the epidemic really is for potentially asymptomatic individuals or individuals who are just feeling like a little bit sick, but not enough to come into the hospital, right? So you need to take these numbers and put them into the context of your community and how you're collecting that data. But there's a very good chance that there is community transmission within your area if you've already detected 13. And it would also be important to look at how quickly you were able to detect those. So how quickly did you go from 0 to 1 to 2 to 13?
And what does community transmission mean?
So for our model, and what's important to create an epidemic is sustained community transmission. So if I go out and I give it to 2 more people, then those 2 people can go out and give it each to 2 more people. And that's how this grows. And that's why we see this exponential growth until we reach herd immunity. So that's why social distancing is so important and wearing a face mask, because we want people to limit how much they're going out and spreading. We want to push that number down to a low 1. So if on average I go out and only give my disease to 0.5 people, then it will die out. And that's what we're really trying to do.
Regarding your study, it appears that the probability for epidemics across the country is extremely high. Could you clarify that for us?
Yes. So that number is right directly correlated with the number of cases detected, right? So again, you need to put that into the context of how much is your community testing. If you think that you're out testing and you're capturing 1 in 10 infected individuals, then that's a good number and that matches with what your community is doing. If your community, on the other hand, is simply not looking at all and you have 0 detected cases, right, then your epidemic probability is not going to be 9%.
It appears in counties where there are at least 10 detected cases of COVID-19, the probability for an epidemic is above 90%. What does that mean?
So the way our simulations work is we did 10,000 simulations, and then we took the proportion of those, which ones met our 2 criteria for having an epidemic. And so that's where that number comes from. And so if you have higher, if we've detected 10, and it's like of simulations that had 10 detections, how many had an epidemic? And so that's how many had an epidemic.
Is there anything I didn't ask you about your work that you'd like to add?
It's just really important for people to follow CDC guidelines and make sure that testing is expanding and you're lobbying the people who are in charge of your area to do that. And so testing not just the most severe cases, but the people who maybe feel okay, but we could know. And it's even important to test people who maybe felt sick a while ago, but feel okay now, to understand whether or not they are now resistant. And I think that's really how we're going to get back on track as a community, is only if we can really expand testing.
That was Emily Javon, lead author of a new study out by the University of Texas at Austin. She spoke with NSPR's Andre Bayek. You can find a link to the study at our website, mynspr.org. We're coming up on our third week indoors after California Governor Gavin Newsom issued a stay-at-home order on March 19th. For some, this has been a time to relax, do yard work, invest in a hobby, or spend more time with the family. For others, though, these past few weeks might be very different, instead putting them in a dangerous situation of having more time with their abuser. Because of this, domestic violence services in the North State are preparing for a potential spike in domestic violence cases. NSPR's Christian Solis has more.
Increased cases of domestic violence may be one serious side effect of a statewide stay-at-home order. But so far, as the past weeks have gone by, Redding Police Corporal Timothy Renault says that he has not noticed anything out of the ordinary.
We haven't seen any drastic increase, anything that's abnormal than what we've normally see during this time of year or during this type of weather.
His observations seem to hold up elsewhere in the North State as well, with Butte County Sheriff Department Community Relations Coordinator Megan McMahon reporting that case numbers in Butte County also remain at normal levels. While officials are not seeing an increase in domestic violence across the region at this point, Anna Hutchinson, the Client Services Director at One Safe Place out of Redding, says that domestic violence services are prepared for one.
So right now our numbers are down, but we absolutely expect them to go up.
She says that after the car fire in 2018, her organization saw a 28% increase in service visits within 3 months after the fire.
Research has shown that after any kind of natural disaster or community-wide trauma, stressful event, reports of domestic violence, sexual assault, child abuse, elder abuse, all of it tend to go up.
Researchers say this increase in types of reports after a crisis may occur due to periods of high stress and the fact that the abuser is now spending more time at home rather than work. Hutchinson says this pandemic has put people who are following a shelter-in-place order and living with an abuser in a situation where they now have little contact with anyone outside their immediate family unit.
For kids, this means that they're not seeing teachers and other mandated reporters who would have a duty to get involved if they saw something that was not safe for the child.
She says for parents and adults, this means that not only do they not have anyone else around to make sure things are physically okay,
but they're also not going to have anyone around to challenge the point of view that may be being imposed by an abusive partner.
People being trapped in isolation with an abuser is also a worry of Sarah Sullivan, Prevention and Outreach Program Manager at Catalyst in Chico.
We are absolutely concerned about seeing an uptick in domestic violence. We are closely monitoring the situation and the calls we get, and we are already seeing some additional barriers that have been created for victims during this time of social distancing and shelter in place.
Sullivan says firearms in the household is an additional hazard on her radar during this pandemic. She says California and other states around the country are not only seeing more reported increases in the purchase of firearms and ammunition, but also in first-time gun buyers.
Owning a gun is not necessarily dangerous by itself. If a woman is in a relationship with an abusive person, their likelihood of homicide increases by 500% when a gun is present in the abusive relationship. And more than half of women murdered with guns are killed by family members or intimate partners. So we know there's a direct correlation between gun violence and domestic violence.
Living at home with an abuser during the stay-at-home order is not the only option. Domestic violence agencies say they are open and willing to help. A few other ways to connect with those outside of the situation is through email or Facebook. It's also advised to set up a safe word with a friend who can make contact with an agency or law enforcement on your behalf. Anna Hutchinson said that one safe place is also working with lodging services to provide a safe room where those living in abusive situations can isolate. But she says when it comes to seeking help,
no one is the expert of what is safest for someone in domestic violence other than that person. We try to provide a number of avenues and, you know, to be perfectly honest, if someone is in such extreme danger that they can't reach out first, that they need to just come to our facility, we will make that work. We are obviously trying to limit foot traffic and walk-in traffic, but if it's a question of someone's safety from an abusive partner, we will help them regardless of how they reach out.
During this pandemic, no domestic violence services are going away, and agencies and officials say they aren't shying away from the challenges that are presented. Corporal Timothy Renault out of the Reading Police wanted to make sure listeners understand.
Although, you know, things have changed in our community, we're on a kind of a, this is uncharted territory for a lot of us because of what's going on here. The Reading Police will continue to respond to calls and deal with suspects of domestic battery accordingly.
For NSPR News, I'm Christian Solis.
And if you are experiencing domestic violence, One Safe Place in Reading and Catalyst in Chico both have 24-hour hotlines that you can call. The hotline for One Safe Place is 244-0117. That's 244-0117. To reach Catalyst Hotline, dial 895-8476. That's 895-8476. You're listening to special coverage from North State Public Radio. More just ahead. This is special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. It's been widely reported that the virus that's causing this pandemic originated from a bat in Wuhan, China. Many past viruses have also been linked to animals. To learn more, NSPR's Dave Shlom spoke with Pranav Pandit and Tierra Smiley Evans, both researchers from UC Davis's One Health Institute at the UC Davis Veterinary School of Medicine, which is an interdisciplinary group of scientists and researchers studying the connection between animals, humans, and the environment. Dave first wanted to know if there was a term for diseases that people can catch from animals.
Yes, we do have a term for pathogens basically that transmit from animals to humans, and we call them zoonotic pathogens.
And what are, you know, give us some examples of that we would probably all know before the coronavirus came along of ways in which diseases that we might know of are transmitted from animals. What are some examples? Like, I know, you know, rabies would be the classic example.
Right. So rabies is a very classic example. And for a human to get infected by rabies, there has to be a transmission from animals to humans. It's almost practically rare or impossible for rabies to transmit from a human to another human. But then there are other zoonotic diseases as well that basically jump from animals to humans, and then there is a continuous transmission between humans. So those are a different set of zoonotic pathogens. And right now, we can probably consider if this coronavirus is a zoonotic spillover initially from animals to humans, right now we can see that there is a constant transmission between different humans.
Do we know where this virus came from? Because, you know, I've heard the story, you hear many stories depending on where you look, and I try to be very careful in where I get sources of information. I prefer to get them from people like you. Did it come from a bat in a Chinese market, or is that apocryphal? Do we know that?
It's an active area of research, and I think we will know a lot more as more researchers are able to get in and more science is able to be done. But right now, what we can do is we can look at viruses that have been discovered in the past and that we already know exist. And to date, there have been quite a number of coronaviruses that have been discovered in bats, particularly in China. And when you look at all of the genetic sequences of the known coronaviruses and you compare it with the sequence of the viruses coming out of Wuhan in humans, the closest relative appears to be a bat in Yunnan province, China, on the border with Myanmar. So it's possible that either the virus jumped directly from a bat into a human, or there could also have been an additional intermediary host where it jumped from a bat to another animal that we don't know yet what that species is, and then to a human. So it's a very active area of research that we're still investigating, and many people are still investigating.
So the story of this one guy who you somehow gets it from a bat, eating it or whatever, and then goes into the marketplace and starts the spread, we don't know that that's exactly true?
That's right. We don't know really how exactly it happened in terms of one guy having a specific interaction with bats. There might be multiple spillover events that might have happened from bats to humans, or there might be just one a spillover event, and then that person was infective and started infecting other people.
It seems to me from, you know, the research I've done, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, there are certain animal species that really are carriers of viruses, like, for example, birds and the avian flu. They carry that here in the North State. And that bats seem to be particularly adept at carrying viruses. Why is that? Why are birds and bats, do we know, what is it about them that makes them these great hosts for viruses? Because the virus doesn't really affect them, they just carry it, is that right?
If we really look at data about what viruses bats or bird species are carrying, we can definitely say that bats are known to carry more number of viruses per species than other taxonomic groups, let's say rodents or primates. So there are different hypotheses that are going around, and scientists are trying to test them. One of them is they being special in terms of their metabolism, because they are the only flying mammals, truly flying mammals. We also need to consider that bats are one of the most numerous species in mammals. So if there are about 5,000 known mammals in the world, about 1,200 of them are bats. So they are quite numerous. And bats also tend to live in large congregations. So there'll be roosts of bats which will have millions of individuals. So there are some peculiarities that epidemiologists and disease ecologists think that might be contributing to them harboring quite a lot of viruses without affecting them significantly. So that's something that always interests disease ecologists a lot.
And Tierra, I would like you to ask you, what are some of the things going on at UC Davis right now in your area or that you know of that are specifically, you know, helping us to work on fighting this coronavirus, this terrible pandemic going around the world? What are some of the things that UC Davis is doing right now?
Yeah, thanks. So our specific group, because we're at the One Health Institute, we have been running a project called the PREDICT Project, which is part of the USAID Emerging Pandemic Threats Program. And it's been a program that's been running for about 10 years that has been focused on countries around the world that are believed to be hotspots for emerging zoonotic diseases. And it's been working really hard to try to build capacity in those regions for both wildlife surveillance and human surveillance, and trying to characterize the interfaces that are bringing humans and wildlife into close contact. So since our group was such well positioned already, having spent many years working with all of these various partners around the world, we were asked to, for the next 6 months, try to pivot our work to specifically focus on helping with the COVID-19 pandemic. Part of that work now is both looking at retrospectively collected samples. So we've collected 10 years worth of biological samples from wildlife and humans that we have banked in various parts of the world. So we're going to be going back to those samples and looking for SARS coronavirus 2 and trying to find out exactly what the reservoir is, if there are additional animals involved, and the geographic distribution of it, and also trying to help our partner laboratories with the COVID-19 response. So trying to help them with their testing strategies, troubleshooting their diagnostic tests, and helping in any way that we can. It's a huge challenge, and we're trying our best to be as useful with the resources that we have.
I'm wondering about, as our planet warms, we have seen in the past, you know, information that we're going to see more of these emerging diseases and viruses in a warming planet. Do you think that as we go into the future that we're going to see more and more of these kinds of episodes from, you know, perhaps diseases we don't even know about yet?
Tiara?
Okay, I'll take that one. I want to say that I hope we learn something from what's going on right now. So, you know, we have been seeing an exponential increase in spillover of viruses from wildlife to humans. And really, it's not the wildlife's fault. They've had these pathogens, you know, they've evolved with them. They've always had them. So it's not a matter of, you know, these wildlife are coming out to get us. It's our actions. It's a human's behavior. It's what we're doing and how we're interacting with our planet. So we have a larger ecological footprint as a human species today than we have ever in the history of the world. So we're encroaching on these animals' habitats. We're eating them. We're building houses next to where they live. We are building, you know, large amounts of agricultural domestic animal production sites close to where wildlife live. And all of these things that we're doing are really, you know, risky behaviors. And people have been studying this and talking about this for, you know, quite some time. But it always tends to take a major public health event for people to start recognizing that. So I'm hoping, you know, this is a terrible tragedy, what's happening right now in the world, but I'm hoping that there can be something good that comes out of it, and that people start paying more attention to how we are interacting with our planet, and that we can be safer going forward.
That was Tiara Smiley-Evans and Pranav Pandit, researchers from UC Davis's One Health Institute, speaking with NSPR's Dave Schlom. And that is your program for Wednesday, April 8th, 2020. If you have any thoughts for us, leave them on our message line, 433-9216, or you can go to our website, mynspr.org. Tonight's special coverage was produced by Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Christian Solis, Andre Bayek, and Phil Wilkie. Our technical producer is Matt Fidler. Thank you for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, News Director at North State Public Radio, and this is Special Coverage. We'll be back tomorrow evening at 6:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and take care.